and not some kind of superhuman who elegantly copes with whatever life throws at her. I hate to say it, but I might be tempted to keep it. She honks out a laugh. But you're right. It's probably Afghans. Or her cane. Or a 50% off coupon for an order of wings at the Wig and Pen. 2 days later, Huck sees the Jeep with the tinted windows parked outside the mini-mart in front of Rum Lines just as someone is climbing into the front seat. The someone appears to be a white female, small in stature. Huck chuckles, probably just some local concerned about the sun. Although, if it were a local, he would have seen the Jeep before. Maybe she just bought it. It's not impossible. Irene gets hold of her Iowa City attorney, Ed Sorley. The assets are a collection of blue-chip stocks that Millie has apparently had for decades. They are currently valued at $117,000. Irene is jubilant. The assets are clean, she says. They were investments Russ's father made years and years ago that Millie never touched. And she left it all to you? Huck says. You're rich. It's breathing room, Irene says. I'm going to split it four ways. Me, Cash, Baker, and Maya. Maya? For her education. AC. Just let me do it, please, Irene says. She's Russ's daughter, Millie's granddaughter. I'm not arguing with you about it. Okay, Huck says. Should we celebrate? Maya is with Ayers tonight, so it's just the two of us. Shambles? Irene says. Huck chuckles. Shambles is Irene's new obsession. It's a brightly painted local bar at mile marker 2 on the Centerline Road that overlooks the Paradise Lumber Yard and a mechanic's car-strewn lot. The place puts the loca in local, which is maybe what Irene likes about it, along with the drinks. The first time they went, the bartender Nathan made Irene a rum punch that she claimed was magic, or maybe just strong. The food is better than it needs to be. It's downright delicious. Huck and Irene pull up bar stools, then order a couple of rum punches and pulled pork sandwiches with fries and slaw. They chat with the mechanic and his wife and a couple visiting from Toronto. Nathan slips Irene a second rum punch and, Huck suspects, maybe even a third, because by the time they're ready to leave, Irene has talked the couple from Toronto into booking a fishing charter. Ha! Irene says as they climb into the truck. That was fun, and I made it rain. We have a full-day charter on Friday.
Good job, AC, Huck says.
When he pulls into the driveway at home, he turns off the ignition, but he stays in the truck, and Irene stays in the truck, and it feels for all the world like he's taking her home after a date. Should he kiss her? He promised to let her make the first move. She places her hand on his thigh. She takes off her seatbelt and scoots closer to him. She raises her face to his cheek. He can smell the rum and fruit on her breath. How magic were those rum punches? He wonders.
AC, he says. There's something I have to tell you.
He warns her they'll be difficult to read.
It's the story of their relationship, he says. Start to finish. I can give you the Cliff Notes version, if you'd rather.
Irene shakes her head, clutching the journals to her chest. Instantly, he wants to snatch them back. Rosie never intended those journals for Huck's eyes, and she definitely never intended them for Irene's eyes. When I found out about Rosie and Russ, I told myself that I would find a way to forgive them, Irene says. Maybe understanding how it all unfolded will make that easier.
No, Huck thinks, it won't. Maybe, he says.
She's standing in front of her bedroom door. The air between them is charged, yes? Maya is away overnight for the first time since Irene moved in. I appreciate you giving these to me, Irene says. I'm sure it was a hard decision.
Torturous, Huck says. He needs a cigarette, badly. Well, good night, AC.
Wait, Irene says. She opens the bedroom door, sets the journals on the nightstand, and reemerges to give him a kiss. It's a real kiss, long and delicious, that leaves Huck breathless and aching. She pulls away for a second, then comes back in for more. Huck is very careful with his hands. One is on her shoulder, one on the side of her face. Her fingers are linked through his belt loops. He forgets about the cigarette, about the journals, about the FBI, about the Jeep with the tinted windows, about Rosie, Russ, Leanne. He's here with Irene in this moment. It's all he wants in the world. She reels him in. She lets him go. She reels him in a little closer. He's hooked. She is the angler cupcake. She lets him go, pulls away, smiles at him. That's all for tonight, she says. Huck raises his palms. He can't speak. She disappears into her room. Huck grabs the Flor de Cagna from the shelf in the kitchen and his pack of Camels and goes out to the deck. The next day, Irene is fine. She's normal. She tells the boys about the money from Millie. Baker says he doesn't need his share. He got a windfall from Anna. He tells Irene to split his portion three ways. And Cash is... He seemed more relieved than anything, Irene says. 39 grand is a big boost for him, so I thought he'd be more excited. He sounds preoccupied. Tilda has just left on a work trip with an investor in this project her parents have cooking, and he's bothered by that.
Women, Huck says. They'll get you every time.
Irene's expression is inscrutable. Has she read the diaries? Huck is afraid to ask, but his gut tells him the answer is no. The next day, they have the charter with the couple from Toronto whose names, Huck sees when he checks the confirmation text from Destiny, are Jack and Diane Boyle.
Little ditty, Huck thinks, about Jack and Diane.
He wonders how many times those poor folks have heard people sing that to them. Huck makes coffee for himself and Irene, makes an egg and toast with papaya jam from Jake's for Maya. Irene has yet to come out of her room, which is unlike her.
Is Irene okay? Maya asks. I thought I heard her crying late last night.
Crying? Huck's heart sinks. Hurry it up, Nut. I'm going to run you to school a little early, then come back and scoop up Irene.
Maya shovels in her egg, takes her toast to go.
Huck calls out, Be right back, AC.
The black Jeep with the tinted windows is waiting in the elbow joint of Jacob's ladder, a step closer than it was the last time. Huck stares at the place where the driver would be. If the Jeep is still there when he comes back, he's going to knock on the window. As soon as Huck and Maya pass, the Jeep follows them. In his rear view, Huck can see the woman. Brown hair pulled back, round face. He doesn't recognize her. When he turns left, the Jeep turns right toward Cruz Bay.
Okay, Huck thinks.
The driver doesn't seem particularly villainous, but there's no denying she's watching them. Who is she? When Huck gets back to the house, Irene is out front. Her hair is braided, she has her sunglasses on, her face is grim. She climbs in the truck and slams the door a little harder than necessary.
I take it you read the journals.
I don't want to talk about it until after this charter, Irene says. But you should know. Today will be my last day working for you.
What? Huck says. Irene? I don't want to talk about it, Irene says, until after this charter. This charter was my doing, and although I would rather be anywhere else today, I'm honoring my commitment. But after today, Huck, no, I'm sorry.
She's angry, Huck thinks. She's hurt.
He's an idiot. He should have handed the journals over to Agent Vasco. Honesty be damned. What makes matters worse is that the charter with Jack and Diane is magnificent from start to finish. Diane is a nurturer. She's the mother of six, she tells them, and she has brought treats for the entire day, starting with a thermos of coffee and sausage and egg sandwiches from Provisions, which Huck knows Irene loves, though since losing the villa, she can't spare the money for them. Jack is a terrific guy, a regional manager for a Canadian bookstore chain called Indigo. Huck has never heard of it, but Irene has. Apparently, it's like the Barnes & Noble of Canada. Jack and Diane are hearty. They're excited to go offshore and try their luck with the fish.
We're here, aren't we? Jack says. Let's go for it.
Huck cranks the music. He starts with John Cougar Just for Fun, and they love it, singing along, arms raised in the air and then wrapped around each other. In his mind, Huck changes Jack and Diane to Huck and Irene.
Hold on to 16 as long as you can. Amen, Huck thinks.
The water is smooth, and the boat skates along with barely a bump. Right before they reach Tombo, they get a hit on the outrigger line. Huck stops the boat. Irene is already handing the rod to Diane, who, after a short fight, brings in a respectable-sized wahoo, bright as a bar of sterling silver. Irene handles the gaff like a pro now. As Huck watches her, he thinks there's no way she's leaving. She loves this boat too much, this job, him. That kissing the other night was real stuff. Nothing that's in the journals, things that happened years ago, can dismantle that. They move on to Tombo. The birds are out. There are fish around. They get another bite and Jack takes it. Mahi, a beauty. Then they get another hit and another. Diane takes one rod, Irene the other, while Huck helps Jack with his fish. Diane brings in a barracuda, Irene another wahoo. Then there's a lull. The best kind of lull, Huck thinks. Jack cracks open a beer, and Diane and Irene settle down to talk about books. Irene says she just finished The Vacationers. Diane says she loves Louise Penny.
I'm probably biased because she's a woman and she's Canadian, but I think she's the best mystery writer alive.
Huck likes mysteries, Irene says, at exactly the same time that Huck says,
I read mysteries.
How long have you two been together? Diane asks.
She smiles from under the brim of a Blue Jays cap.
Jack and I have been dating since 8th grade.
My one and only, Jack says.
Huck waits for Irene to answer Diane. They've been asked this before, of course, and Irene normally handles it by saying they're not together, that she is just the mate, and everyone is always surprised because they seem like a couple. They finish each other's sentences.
I'm just a hired hand, Irene says, and today is my last day. I'm moving on. You guys will be my last clients on the Mississippi.
Save the best for last,
Jack says, raising his beer. Huck has a lump in his throat. She said it out loud to strangers. She's leaving. Today is her last day. This doesn't mean it's carved in stone, he tells himself. She'll calm down. She'll reconsider. She has to. Please God. He can't believe he's being punished for telling the truth.
Will you leave the island? Diane asks. Go back to...
Iowa, Irene says. Huck lights a cigarette in the stern. His nerves are splintering.
No, Irene says. I'm going to go for my captain's license and get my own boat.
What?
Huck thinks.
What?
Good for you, Diane says. Girl power.
The line whizzes. Fish on, Huck says, though he couldn't care less. Wahoo, mahi, barracuda, mahi, then lunch, sandwiches from Sam and Jack's, and a bottle of champagne that Diane brought.
It's the 45th anniversary of our first date, Diane says, way back in 1974.
She pours the champagne into four paper cups and passes them around.
But we had no idea you had something to celebrate as well, Irene, captaining your own boat.
Diane raises her cup.
Hear, hear.
Somehow, Huck makes himself sip the champagne. He sees Diane grinning at him.
You must be an excellent teacher.
She's a natural, Huck says.
He's directing his words at Irene, willing her to look at him.
She's the angler cupcake.
When Jack and Diane disembark at the National Park Service dock, there are hugs and handshakes all around. Great day, perfect weather, tons of fish, highlight of their vacation. They'll post their pictures on Facebook and write a 5-star review on TripAdvisor. Huck's heart is broken. Irene is silent in the truck, and Huck knows not to make any stops on the way home. When he pulls up Jacob's Ladder, he looks for the Jeep with the tinted windows, but it's not there. He says,
There's a strange Jeep that's been lurking around here. Black with tinted windows. Female driver.
Irene says nothing.
Maya is at Joni's, which is good, Huck thinks, because they can talk freely.
Irene hops out of the truck and goes around to grab the smaller cooler out of the back like she always does, leaving Huck to handle the bigger cooler. Jack and Diane took 4 pounds of the mahi, but there's a lot of fish left. Huck needs to call the restaurants, La Tapa, Morgan's Mango, Extra Virgin, Lime Inn. But first,
Irene, he says.
She disappears inside, and when Huck comes in, she's standing in the hallway with the journals in her hands. She reads aloud.
I'm sex and lobster and champagne drinking under a blanket of stars. Irene is home and hearth, mother of the boys, keeper of the traditions that make a family.
Irene, Huck says, please stop. I tried to warn you.
Can I lure Russ away from her? Can I make him feel his family is here? I can try. In the new year, I decided I'm going to introduce him to Maya.
I know, Irene. I read them.
You don't know, Irene says. Her voice wavers. He was my husband. I trusted him. Rosie knew I existed, Huck. She knew about me. She knew about the boys from day one, minute one. She knew about the house I was building. She knew how I was decorating it. She thought I was some kind of shrew who didn't appreciate Russ, didn't respect him or honor his sacrifices, didn't love or worship him the way he deserved.
In a move so uncharacteristic that Huck can't believe it's happening, Irene throws the journals down the hall. They land at his feet, splayed open, like birds shot out of the sky.
She wanted him to leave me. She wanted him to propose.
For the record, Huck says, at the time, I had no idea any of this was going on.
Your wife did, Irene says. Leanne!
Watch it, Huck says. Please.
Leanne knew I existed. She knew my name.
Yes, and if you read carefully, Leanne said that if Rosie didn't stop seeing Russ, she would call you.
Huck clears his throat.
Leanne didn't condone the relationship for 1 second, Irene. She never would have. She wasn't like that.
What about you, Huck? You expect me to believe that Leanne didn't tell you what she read in the diaries? You weren't informed that Rosie was seeing a married man?
Leanne kept her business with Rosie between herself and Rosie.
But you were her husband.
Huck gives Irene a hard stare.
I'm not sure I owe you an explanation about the way things were in my marriage. I didn't know Leanne read the diaries, and I sure as hell didn't know what was in them.
He sighs. Leanne and Rosie's relationship was tumultuous, Irene. It had deep fault lines that weren't visible to the casual observer. Although most of the time things were fine between them, there would be tremors. And some of those tremors turned into earthquakes. I didn't get in the middle, so no. I didn't know Rosie was seeing a married man.
And when she started seeing Russ after Leanne died? The invisible man, Huck? You didn't ask questions?
After Leanne died, I was lost for a long time. I was self-absorbed. I knew Rosie was dating someone. I asked to meet him, and Rosie was dead set against it. I didn't push. Maybe I should have, but she was a grown woman.
She was living under your roof. She was your
daughter, Huck says. Yes. Yes, she was. But you have two grown children of your own, Irene. Are you accountable for their actions?
My sons are good people, Irene says. I raised them right.
Fine, I agree. You did. That's not my point. My point is you can't control how they act. Cash lost the stores in Colorado. Was that your fault? Both Baker and Cash lied to Ayers about who they were when they first got here. Was that your fault?
No, Irene says.
Rosie made a mistake, Irene, but as the saying goes, it takes two to tango. That affair was 50% her fault.
Huck feels his blood pressure rising.
I could just as easily be furious that Russ led Rosie on for so many years. That Russ's business dealings got her killed. Leaving my granddaughter without a mother.
He's losing control, and it feels good. Irene isn't the only one allowed to feel angry and hurt. The affair was 50% Russ's fault, but the illegal business was 100% his fault. Irene stares at Huck for a long second, her eyes narrowed.
Love is messy and complicated and unfair, she says, quote unquote from Rosie herself, and I agree. It's not fair that I have feelings for the man who should be my enemy. Your words just now crystallized our problem. You should be furious with Russ. He was to blame for their deaths, at least indirectly. We're on different sides of this, Huck. And because of that, I can't work for you and I can't live here. I'm sorry.
So, what? Huck says. You're quitting and you're moving out? Where will you go?
To Baker's for the time being. Then I'll figure something out, Irene says. It's none of your concern.
None of your concern.
How can she say that?
What you told Jack and Diane is true? Huck asks. You're striking out on your own? Getting your captain's license? Starting your own charter? Any idea how difficult that's going to be? You don't know anyone on this island except for me.
This comes out all wrong. He sounds like a complete bastard when what he really wants to say is, please don't leave me.
I'm going to pack my things, Irene says, which shouldn't take long, but I'd appreciate it if you weren't here when I left.
Oh, that's rich, Huck says. You're ordering me out of my own house. After I took you in and gave you a home and gave you a job and...
He wants to say gave you my love. But no, he won't let her have the satisfaction.
She wants to leave? Fine, she can leave. She wants to throw away the relationship? Great.
Maybe she's right. Maybe they are on different sides of this goddamn situation. Maybe the stupidest thing he ever did was let her on his boat that first day.
But even as Huck is thinking this, he knows it's not true. They are on the same side because they're alive. They're the survivors.
I'll leave, Huck says. But just remember what you told me yesterday, Irene.
She cocks an eyebrow. Her expression now is more sassy than angry. She looks like a rebellious teenager.
You said
you would find a way to forgive them.
Irene retreats to the bedroom and slams the door behind her. When Huck gets out to his truck, he lights a cigarette and flies down Jacob's ladder faster than he should. He checks the spot where the black Jeep with the tinted windows was waiting that morning, but it's not there. Too bad, because he's in the mood for a confrontation. He wonders if the woman is a reporter, or someone sent by the FBI to watch them, or someone sent by Croft to watch them. Maybe it's good that Irene is leaving. He doesn't need strangers lurking around him and his granddaughter. When Huck reaches the bottom of the hill, he has to decide where he's going. He could pick up some barbecue from Candy's, but he won't be able to eat a thing, and Maya would be just as happy with peanut butter and jelly. Her own charter boat. Ha! He should have passed the journals on to Vasco. People think they want the truth, but they can't handle the truth. Huck supposes it's possible that Irene would have reacted like this if he'd given the journals to the FBI without telling her about them. He was damned either way. He toys with the idea of going to a bar for a beer and a shot, something to calm him down. But that's not the answer tonight. He could only too easily end up like Mick, chained to a bar stool at CBL, making a spectacle of himself. Huck drives through town, past Mongoose Junction, and up the wide, sweeping hill to the sunset view spot over Cruise Bay. He pulls over and parks. There are a dozen or so people, several couples and one family, waiting for the sun to drop into the ocean. They have their cameras out, of course. These days, a picture of a thing is more important than the thing itself. But Huck is old enough to remember otherwise. He's old enough to watch the sun go down and the fiery pink brush stroking the clouds and do nothing but think. At first, he's melancholy. The sun is setting on the last day he will ever spend with the Angler Cupcake, Irene Steele. But then he thinks, no, that won't do. He's a pretty smart guy, resourceful. He's going to find a way to get her back. Ayers. The phone rings at midnight, but Ayers doesn't wake up until she feels Winnie's cold nose pushing against the back of her hand. The dog has proven to be eerily in touch with the human world. Your phone is ringing. Yes, Ayers hears the muffled tone. She digs it out from under the rumpled covers of her bed. The screen tells her it's Mick. Ayers huffs and hits decline. She was so tired after her shift at La Tapa that she face-planted on her bed still in her uniform, still in her clogs. And when Winnie jumped onto the bed with her, she didn't protest. The phone goes dark for a second, then lights up again, and again Winnie nudges Ayers.
Ugh,
Ayers says, but she answers. What?
What, Mick, what?
Mick is crying.
What's wrong?
Ayers asks, then remembers that she no longer cares what's wrong.
Can I come over?
He asks.
No,
Ayers says. Please? Ayers summons her resolve. It would be only too easy to relent.
Okay, fine, you can come, but you're not staying long.
Mick would step inside, bringing their 9-year history with him. It's not that Mick is even that attractive, but he's attractive to her. He has that something. Ayers loves his hands, and the tattoo of Gordon's paw print under his left rib, and the way he squints when he looks at her like he's looking at the sun. They have good memories, years of them. Snorkeling and hiking and partying on the water and on land. How many times had Mick anchored a boat off Water Island so they could swim ashore and get bushwhackers from dinghies? How many times had they played the brass ring game at the Soggy Dollar or rolled the dice at Cruise Bay Landing?
How many times did they stand in line together at the post office or at the bank to deposit their paychecks, pinky fingers entwined? How many brunches up at the banana deck? How many hikes to Ramhead? How many times had Mick dropped Ayers off at Driftwood Dave's on their way home from the beach so she could run in for 2 rum punches to go while he drove around the block? How many times had Mick saved Ayers the corner seat at the beach bar while he was working so she could have a front row view of the band? He used to sneak up behind her and kiss her shoulder, take a surreptitious sip of her drink. "I'm asleep," Ayers says. "Go home to bed, Mick, or call Bridget."
"I don't want to call Bridget. I don't care about Bridget. That night at the beach, she trapped me."
"You kissed her, Mick," Ayers says, "right?" They haven't had a conversation since Ayers broke their engagement, so she hasn't heard Mick admit his guilt.
"Yes," Mick says. "I kissed her. We kissed."
Something inside Ayers zips shut, a tiny compartment where she held out hope that maybe it wasn't true. "Thank you for telling me. We're done. I gave you a second chance, and you blew it. I have self-worth and self-respect, and you, my friend, have a problem with commitment, fidelity, and honesty." Ayers runs her hand down Winnie's back for comfort. "This theater production you've been starring in at Cruz Bay Landing is a pathetic plea for attention, but it's also a subtle way to make everyone we know think that this is my fault. You're playing the injured party when you're the one who screwed it up." Ayers' anger energizes her. She sits up, kicks off her clogs. "You're making an ass of yourself. You've become the village idiot."
"I kissed Bridget," Mick says. "I own that. But even if I hadn't kissed Bridget, the engagement would be over." "And why? Why, Ayers?" "Because you're pregnant with Banker's baby, that's why."
Ayers falls back. Winnie gets to her feet and stands over her. "Who told you that?"
"It's all over town," Mick says.
"No," Ayers says. "Did Cash tell Tilda, who then told Skip, who then told Mick?" "I haven't told anyone."
"You didn't have to," Mick says. "You took a leave of absence from the boat? You missed shifts at La Tapa? Skip said he heard you retching in the ladies' room before service. It doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure it out. Skip actually congratulated me, thinking I was the father. But I'm not. Both you and I know that I'm not."
"No," Ayers says.
"And now Banker knows too."
Ayers feels dizzy, like she's on some kind of crazed rocking horse. "What?"
"He and his little boy sat next to me at CBL earlier tonight," Mick says. "I told him."
Ayers is so addled that she's certain there's no way she'll be able to fall back to sleep. But she does immediately. When she wakes up in the morning, there's a text from Baker.
"Good morning. You feeling any better?"
He knows. Does she tell him that she knows he knows? Or should she just pretend the phone call with Mick never happened and tell him herself? The latter. Mick is irrelevant. She thinks about sending a text back, something along the lines of, "Not sick, pregnant. It's yours."
Whoa.
The room is spinning. Ayers races for the bathroom and throws up. When she emerges, Winnie is stationed outside the door. "Do you need to go out?" Ayers asks. Winnie trots over to the front door and waits. "I can't walk you this second, I'm sorry. Just do your thing and come right back, okay?" Ayers opens the door and Winnie obeys, taking care of business efficiently and then slipping back inside past Ayers' legs. She's such a good dog, much better than Gordon, if Ayers is being honest. Gordon would have sniffed around for 20 minutes and couldn't be trusted if a car or another dog came past. Of course, Winnie is female, so that alone explains it. Ayers takes a 4-7-8 breath and pours herself half a glass of warm ginger ale. She calls Baker, who answers on the first ring.
Good morning.
Good morning?
Ayers says. He sounds awfully chipper. It occurs to Ayers that maybe Mick lied about telling Baker that Ayers is pregnant.
Listen, Baker, there's something I need to talk to you about.
If you want to talk in person, I can be there in 2 seconds, Baker says.
What she wants is to hang up and go back to bed. She sighs. She can't put this conversation off much longer.
Okay.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three. There's a knock at the door. Winnie shoots over and starts barking.
Just a minute, Ayers says.
Is that him? Had he been standing outside when she called him? Ayers hurries to the bathroom, takes in her pasty complexion, her bed-mussed hair, her rumpled uniform shirt. Does she stink? Probably. She tries to rub deodorant on without taking off her shirt. She piles her hair on top of her head. Better? Worse? Worse, she decides. She lets it go. Oh, well. When she swings the door open, there's Baker, looking tan and relaxed. He's gorgeous. Tall, broad, smiling in that gee-whiz Midwestern way. Ayers is struck by something she has willfully ignored until now. She likes Baker. A lot. Winnie barks. She wants to jump on him, Ayers can tell. Her slender golden body is shimmying with energy. Her tail is going nuts. It's not her daddy, but close. His brother.
Hey, I recognize you, Baker says to Winnie. And then to Ayers. Hello, beautiful.
If Ayers weren't pregnant, this moment would be so sexy. She would be wearing a bikini or a sundress or hiking shorts, and they would be heading out into the sunshine to start their relationship.
I'm pregnant, she says.
I know, he says. Can I come in?
Ayers figures she's about 6 weeks along. A check of the internet reveals that her baby is likely the size of a pea. Will there come a day 25 or 30 years from now when Ayers tells Sweet Pea about the morning she invited Baker Steele inside her tiny, disheveled home to discuss Sweet Pea's very existence? What will Ayers remember? Baker's handsome face may be forgotten. But what will stick with Ayers is her own sense of bewilderment. She's attracted to Baker, but she doesn't know the first thing about him. He might as well be a stranger at the airport who asks her to travel with a mysterious piece of luggage. They settle on the sofa. Winnie is at Baker's side now, fickle girl.
It's your baby, Ayers says.
I heard.
I want to make that clear. It's yours, not Mick's. Also, I'm finished with Mick.
You're sure? Because you said that last time and it didn't end up being true. I was gone for 2 days and you got engaged to the guy.
When he says it that way, it sounds awful. It was awful. In agreeing to marry Mick, Ayers was unfair to all parties involved, Baker, Mick, and most of all herself.
I thought it was what I'd been waiting for, Ayers says. It was validating after what happened with Bridget to feel like he was choosing me, to feel like I'd won.
You told me that story about your parents in Kathmandu. The hiccup, your mother with another man.
Baker's gaze wanders over to the travel photographs Ayers has on her wall.
In telling me that story, you made me feel like the hiccup.
Ayers can't believe she told Baker the story about her parents in Kathmandu. Her mother had had a brief affair with a British expat bar owner. Or she hadn't, Ayers isn't sure to this day.
Ayers pulled that story out, she supposes, because she wanted to justify forgiving Mick. She was making excuses for him. But she was finished with that now.
This doesn't have to look any certain way, Baker says. First question, do you want to keep the baby?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Great. Second question, do you want to have the baby and still be with Mick, Ayers? If the answer is yes, I will understand.
You will?
Yes. Is that what you want?
No, Ayers says. I told you, I'm finished with Mick. That's my final answer. In the name of self-respect.
Palpable relief emanates from Baker.
But, Ayers says.
But?
I don't know that I can be with you either. Not right away. I think I need to be alone for a while.
Alone?
Romantically alone, yes. I need some time and I need some space.
This is something Ayers has given a lot of thought to. If she weren't pregnant, she might have climbed right into bed with Baker, forging ahead without any introspection. On to the next guy. She would have used Baker like a bandage, plastering his love and devotion over the wounds that Mick left. But being pregnant changes things. Ayers needs to be alone. She needs to worry less about falling in love with someone else, and instead fall in love with herself. It's the best gift she can bestow on this child, a mother who is happy and capable and whole. Ayers puts a hand on Baker's arm.
But we can be friends.
Friends.
Until I feel like I'm ready to start something new. I don't want this baby to dictate my love life. I want my heart to dictate that.
We're not exactly starting from ground zero, Baker says. We have something to work with. I fell in love with you the second I saw you.
Don't say love.
Ayers collapses back into the cushions.
Before I found out I was pregnant, I figured we could just start over. Go on some dates. Take things slow. Do it properly.
That's what I thought too.
Nothing says taking it slow like instant family.
They laugh. It's funny for a few seconds.
You heard we lost the villa?
Baker says.
Maya told me. She said you were looking for a rental?
Yep. I stayed at the Westin for so long that they offered me a job selling timeshares, which I accepted.
Seriously?
I start Monday, Baker says. And I got Floyd settled at Gift Hill with the cool kids.
All the kids at Gift Hill are cool, Ayers says.
My feelings exactly, Baker says.
He gives her an uncomfortable smile.
And I found a villa.
You did? Ayers says. Where?
Across the street, Baker says. The Happy Hibiscus.
At this, Winnie barks in a way that sounds like a laugh.
The Happy Hibiscus? Right across the street?
Yes, Baker says. Floyd and I are moving in today.
Today?
I was just over there dropping off groceries.
Ah, Ayers says.
She rubs Winnie behind the ears. So much for space, she thinks. She and the Steeles are becoming one big, extremely non-traditional family. She casts her eyes skyward. Rosie is either laughing or crying up there. Or both. Cash. The night before Tilda leaves on her week-long research trip with Dunk, she and Cash drink a bottle of Granger's Cristal while skinny dipping in the pool. Granger and Lauren are gone, off to LA, and then Cash makes love to Tilda on the round sunbed under a crescent moon. Later, when they're wrapped in the luscious Turkish towels, gazing at the twinkling lights of Tortola, Tilda cries a little. She doesn't want to go away without him, she says. She's going to miss him.
It's only a week, Cash says.
His casual attitude is an act. He can't believe this is happening. Tilda is going to Anguilla, St. Lucia, and a tiny private island called Eden, home to a resort so exclusive that you have to be invited to stay there. Management curates its guests as though it's selecting art for a museum. How did Tilda and Dunk make the cut? Cash wonders. He hopes it was through Granger's prodigious network and not Dunk's influence. Tilda and Dunk have separate rooms at Midi et Minuit, the resort on Anguilla, and at Emerald Hill on St. Lucia. But of the dozen freestanding villas at Eden, only one is available during Tilda and Dunk's stay, so they'll be sharing. You'd better behave yourself, Tilda says, resting her head on Cash's chest. No picking up women at the Soggy Dollar.
What about you? Cash asks. Are you going to behave yourself?
Oh, please, Tilda says. You never have a thing to worry about with me, but especially not with Dunk. The next day, as Cash is aboard Treasure Island heading for Virgin Gorda, a boat cuts in front of them going at least 60 knots. It's coming from the direction of the East End and heading for St. Thomas. It's the Olive Branch, of course. Tilda and Dunk are sitting in the stern, laughing. Cash hears the captain yell out, and Cash wonders if this will finally be the time James calls the Coast Guard to complain. Or maybe Cash will call the Coast Guard himself. Dunk did this on purpose. Is he trying to make a point to Cash?
I'm taking off with you, girl.
Tilda is wearing a black sundress Cash has never seen before. It's sleek and sophisticated, possibly borrowed from her mother's closet. She's also wearing a pair of dark cat's eye sunglasses, Tom Ford, that Cash knows she lifted from Lauren. When Tilda sees Cash, she waves and blows a kiss. She seems older and more glamorous, as though she outgrew him overnight.
Hold on!
Cash calls to his passengers as the boat slams into the Olive Branch's wake. With Tilda away, Cash has the villa in Peter Bay to himself. Virgie, the housekeeper, has been given the week off. Another guy might revel in the freedom, might make a list of all the ways to push the envelope. Cash can borrow liberally from Granger's wine fridge and make a trip to Starfish Market for thick marbled steaks and charge them to the house account. He can snoop through the master wing. Granger and Lauren's bedroom, sitting room, closets, offices, and bathroom, and see what secrets he can dig up. Money? Pills? He can bring Winnie back. He can let Winnie swim in the pool. Of all these ideas, only the last one holds any appeal. Although Cash suspects that the villa has cameras placed so strategically that he can't even find them and block them. The first night alone, Cash cracks a beer and checks his phone frequently to see if Tilda has texted or called. She and Dunk were taking his boat all the way to San Juan and flying to Anguilla from there. Tilda sent the full itinerary to Cash's phone, and when he looks at it, he sees that she was supposed to land in Anguilla at 3 o'clock. At 7, he still hasn't heard from her, and so what is he to think but that she has forgotten all about him? She and Dunk landed on the tiny airstrip and were whisked away by a private car. Cash pictures a vintage Peugeot to the lush tropical entrance of Midi et Minuit. Midi et Minuit, built in the 1920s, was the private beachfront estate of French perfume heiress Hélène Simon until the early 1980s, when it was transformed into a resort. In those days, it attracted guests like John and Christina DeLorean and Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson, and it was famous for its midnight disco parties. The owners went bankrupt in the crash of 1987, and Midi et Minuit closed until the year 2000, when it was bought by a businessman from Monte Carlo who poured $55 million into the property and turned it into the epitome of low-key luxury and barefoot chic. Cash wonders if Tilda and Dunk were greeted with welcome cocktails and chilled towels, while the hotel's most famous resident, Bijou, a Yorkshire terrier, yipped around Tilda's ankles until she scooped him up and gave him kisses. Were Dunk and Tilda mistaken for a couple? Undoubtedly yes, despite the reservation for separate rooms. Or maybe during their day of travel, Tilda and Dunk had bonded over their excitement about this new venture. Maybe they'd had drinks on the plane, and maybe Tilda fell asleep with her head accidentally leaning on Dunk's shoulder. Maybe by the time they reached the resort, they asked to share a room. But no, not yet, not the first night. Cash has enough faith in Tilda to know that nothing has happened between them yet. Why hasn't she called? Or at least texted to let him know she arrived safely? Cash's fingers hover over his phone. Should he text her? No, he won't. And he's not going to sit around the villa pining away either. He doesn't have money to waste on going out to dinner, but oh well, he's doing it anyway. He drives Tilda's Range Rover into Cruise Bay and sits at the bar at the banana deck. He orders the shrimp curry and chats with the bartender, Kim, who immediately says, "You hang out with Tilda Payne, right? I saw you two at Christmas Cove a few weeks ago. Is she working tonight?"
"She's away," Cash says.
Kim seems friendly enough for Cash to spill his guts to. He could tell her that Tilda is away for a week with some millennial millionaire who lives out in the East End. But how pathetic would that sound? Instead, Cash raises his beer glass. "I'll have another one, please." He stops at two beers, eats his curry, and chats a little more with Kim, telling her that he works on the Treasure Island. She says, "Oh yeah?" and studies him for a second. "You know, rumor has it that Ayers is pregnant." Whoa, this is unexpected. Cash's face must register genuine shock because Kim leans across the bar. "I shouldn't have said that. It's probably not true. Please don't tell anyone."
"Oh, I won't," Cash says.
Kim moves down the bar to help another customer, and Cash realizes their conversation is over. He scans the place to see if anyone looks familiar or even promising to talk to. He needs some friends. He thinks about stopping by La Tapa on his way home to give Ayers a heads up that her secret is out, but that will only upset her. And swinging by Tilda's place of work while Tilda is away feels weird and desperate. Besides which, Skip will be working, and he hates Cash's guts. Cash pays the bill, waves to Kim, and tries to look like a man who has important people to meet. He could check out Beach Bar, see if a band is playing tonight, or he could try his luck at the Parrot Club, though he definitely does not have money to gamble away. Another drink sounds appealing. Maybe at the Doghouse Pub, where he can watch basketball on TV? But he's driving Tilda's Range Rover. It's a $70,000 vehicle, and two drinks is a wise limit. He checks his phone, which he miraculously avoided doing all through dinner. There is nothing more pathetic than a dude alone at dinner looking at his phone, and finds nothing from Tilda. For an instant, he wonders if she's okay. Did her plane crash? Was she kidnapped? Or, a more likely possibility, did something happen to her phone? Did she leave it in the airport restroom? Did it fall into her personal plunge pool? If anything dire had happened, Cash assumes he would have heard from Granger or Lauren. If something happened to her phone, she would have simply texted from Dunk's phone. Tomorrow, maybe he'll see if James, the boat captain, wants to grab a drink. James will say no. He has a wife and a baby girl out in Coral Bay, and he likely gets his fill of Cash while they're on the boat. Well, it's not like Cash doesn't know anyone else on the island. He calls his mother, gets her voicemail,
Then he calls his brother, gets his voicemail. Cash tosses his phone onto the seat beside him and yells as loud as he can. The sound, desperate even to his own ears, is absorbed by the expensive leather. Cash wakes up in the morning to a new day. Chirping geckos, singing birds, blue sky, pearlescent sunlight. There's a text from Tilda. Finally, Cash opens it. It says, "Arrived," followed by a single kissy face emoji, sent at 12:47 a.m. Cash stares at the text, willing it to say something else, something more. She was supposed to land yesterday at 3 in the afternoon. Why is she only texting him at 12:45 the following morning? He checks to see if there's a missed call from her. Nope. So this is it. Technically, it checks the box. She's let him know she made it safely. But it feels perfunctory, like an afterthought. Oops, forgot to text Cash. Does she miss him? If the answer is yes, why doesn't she say so? She used to text that she missed him if the Treasure Island was a few minutes late pulling into Cruz Bay, or if he got held up in the custom house coming back from the BVIs. This feels like a blow-off. Why did she wait so long to text, and what was she doing up so late? Cash texts back, "Glad you made it safely. I miss you." He waits to see if she responds, but there's nothing. She must still be sleeping. While Cash is driving to work, his phone rings and his whole body relaxes. There she is. He's on the dicey curve above Hawk's Nest, so he answers without checking the display. "Hello?" He has the radio up, 104.3 The Buzz out of San Juan, which is playing Michael Franti, and he makes no move to turn it down. He wants to sound happy, busy, unconcerned. "Cash?" It's not Tilda. It's his mother. Cash is so crushed, he nearly hangs up. "Hey," he says, and he does turn down the music. He's no longer in a Sound of Sunshine mood. "Cash, it's Mom. Listen, I have some good news." Good news at this point would be Tilda calling to say that Dunk's picture should be next to douchebag in the dictionary and that she can't stand him another second and is on her way home. Hotel research be damned. He can't believe how strongly he feels about Tilda. He knew the relationship was promising, but his feelings have ratcheted up to the next level now that she's gone. Gone with Dunk. "Oh, really?" Cash says. He wonders briefly if Irene's attorney somehow managed to get the villa back. What a major relief that would be. He could leave Peter Bay and regain at least a little of his self-respect. "Millie's estate is through probate," Irene says. "She had stocks that your grandfather bought back in the late 1970s that were sold for us, to the tune of $117,000. Now, I wanted to split that four ways: you, your brother, Maya, and myself."
"Good call, including Maya," Cash says. "That's really decent of you, Mom."
"Well, just listen. It turns out Baker doesn't need the money. He got money from Anna. So Millie's money will be split three ways. By next week, you'll be $39,000 richer."
$39,000.
Cash knows he should be grateful, but all he can think is that Dunk has enough money to buy an island. Buy an island. This little jaunt Tilda is on must be costing nearly $39,000, if not more.
"Thanks, Mom," he says. "That is good news. I can buy a truck."
"Used," he thinks. "Your brother bought a Jeep," Irene says, "and he found a rental."
"He did?" Cash says, perking up. "How big?"
2 bedrooms, Irene says, "in Fish Bay." Cash's mood darkens.
"I thought he was looking for something bigger."
I can't stay at Tilda's forever, Mom. And what about Winnie? She's living with Ayers.
The villa Baker rented is across the street from Ayers, Irene says. I forgot to ask Baker if he's allowed to have pets. He might be.
Which means that Winnie might have a home. But Cash does not. Thanks for the call, Mom. I'll get you my bank information, but I'm at work now, so I should go.
Honey, Irene says, is everything okay?
Cash sighs. His mother knows him. His mother loves him. They have always been allies. And if anyone on this earth can relate to feeling abandoned, it's his mother. Except she seems pretty happy with Huck.
Tilda went away for a week with another guy, Cash says. Some super wealthy investor who's funding this eco-resort that Tilda and her parents want to build on Livongo Key.
They went away together?
Like, together, together? Supposedly all business, Cash says. Tilda said he turns her stomach.
Had Tilda said this?
No, this is how Cash feels. Dunk turns his stomach.
Whatever. I guess we'll see.
If it makes you feel any better, Irene says, she'd be a fool to leave you.
Cash shakes his head.
Thanks, Mom.
On the second day, Tilda texts Cash a selfie. It's just her face. She has her mother's sunglasses on. She's lying back on a chaise in the sun. Cash responds by texting her a selfie he takes on the bow of Treasure Island, his sunglasses and headset on, wind blowing his hair. He feels like a jackass. The third day, Tilda sends a text that says, "Off to St. Lucius," with a kissy face emoji. Cash texts back, "Have fun." He can't believe the minimalist nature of her communication. One text a day? No calls at all? Of course, Cash hasn't called her either. Should he? No, he thinks. But an instant later, he does call her. The phone rings 6 times. He hears the funny tone that means she's in another country. Then her voicemail picks up. She texted only 2 minutes earlier. Is she so busy that she can't say a quick hello? Maybe she's on the plane. Or maybe she's frantically packing, trying to get out of the hotel room and meet her car to the airport. There could be lots of reasons she can't talk. Cash hangs up. Cash realizes he hates being trapped in the villa in Peter Bay and, hidden cameras be damned, he starts flagrantly breaking the rules. Okay, maybe not flagrantly. Cash doesn't have a rule-breaking bone in his body. He cautiously breaks the rules. He drinks 6 of Granger's Island Hoppin' IPAs and samples the whiskey in the crystal decanter that he finds in Granger's study. Granger's study is dark and serious. There's a portrait of Abraham Lincoln on the wall. Then again, the Payne family is from Illinois, so maybe this makes sense. The desk is backed by a wall of books, nothing leather-bound, though they're all hardcovers, fiction, it looks like. Tilda mentioned that Granger is a prodigious and serious reader. Cash sees they're alphabetized by author, like in a bookstore. Nabokov, Nesbo, Ng. The surface of Granger's desk is clear, and the drawers are all locked. Cash checks. He's looking, of course, for notes. Some record of Granger's impressions of Duncan Huntley, or possibly even their financial arrangement. So Cash takes only the whiskey. But even that feels like getting away with something. Before going to sleep on the third night, Cash moves out of Tilda's wing and into the guest wing, which is where Cash brought Tilda's friend Max after Max got drunk and sick on Treasure Island. Tilda's wing of the house is cluttered with Tilda's clothes, books, magazines, sunglasses, bikinis, hair products, a bunch of half-burned Nest-scented candles, corkscrews, the cheap vinyl drawstring backpacks she likes to carry, and pairs of hiking boots, water shoes, and work clogs, as well as receipts and piles of cash,
her tips from various nights that she doesn't ever bother to count or deposit. But the guest wing is immaculate. The wing is two stories connected by a floating staircase that appears to be magically suspended in air. Upstairs is a comfy sitting room with a huge television and a perfect little palm green and white tiled kitchenette that has a petal pink mini fridge filled with soft drinks and beer. How did Cash not know about this? He takes an Island Hoppin' IPA, thank you very much. The bedroom is downstairs. There's a four-poster mahogany bed draped with white shears that looks like what a bed in heaven must look like. Out a sliding glass door is a private garden and a deep circular plunge pool. Home for the night, Cash thinks. He doesn't have to go into the main house at all. He's getting $39,000 free and clear. After he finishes his beer, he feels happy about this. He can buy a truck and stop driving Tilda's Rover around like he's the errand boy. Cash has a difficult time falling asleep in the guest wing. The bed is too soft, and it doesn't smell like Tilda. It's 10:45. He could still go out. Cruise Bay isn't exactly a late-night town, but Cash knows the Parrot Club will be open. He can take what's left in his bank account and gamble, now that he knows there's more money coming. Cash gets all the way out to the driveway before he comes to his senses. He's been drinking. He should not get behind the wheel of the Rover, and he should not piss all his hard-earned money away at the Parrot Club. He has a full charter tomorrow. He should go to bed. He does go to bed, back in Tilda's wing, his face buried in her pillow. Working on Treasure Island has been a good distraction. There's nothing like being responsible for 30 people as they swim, snorkel, often for the first time, and drink copious amounts of alcohol to keep one in the present moment. But on day 4 of not talking to Tilda, honestly, what's going on? Has she not thought to call Cash even once? Cash finds himself short on patience. It doesn't help that he has a guest on the boat who reminds him of Duncan. This guy, Bradley, is an aggressive, in-your-face hipster. He's exactly Dunk's height and build, and he's wearing jeans. Jeans, on a trip to the BVI's, and a plain white t-shirt that looks like it came out of a 3-pack of Hanes, but probably was made by Rick Owens and cost $400. And he's wearing a flashy gold Omega. Cash notices the jeans and the watch when Bradley checks in, but not his Versace slip-on loafers, which he refuses to be separated from when it's time to board the boat. Cash says calmly, "Take your shoes off and put them in the basket, or I will leave you here." "Oh, yeah?" Bradley says, squaring his shoulders. Cash lifts the rope from the bollard. Everyone is aboard except for Bradley, who remains in his shoes on the dock. "Yeah," Cash says. Reluctantly, Bradley removes his precious shoes and hands them over to his girlfriend, who, Cash remembers from check-in, is named Gretchen Gingerman. She puts them in her oversized Fendi bag. Bradley stays in the shade of the wheelhouse while Gretchen fetches him drinks. Gretchen has golden hair, is 3 inches taller than Bradley, and has the face and body of a supermodel. Cash tries not to look too closely, but Gretchen Gingerman seems pretty damn perfect.